Gawain. Esmeralda Santiago's new novel, Conquistadora, begins in 19th century Seville, Spain. Anna, the headstrong daughter of an aristocratic family, dreams of a more exciting life after reading travel journals and diaries. She marries, sails to Puerto Rico, where she runs a sugar plantation that depends on slave labor. This book is a sprawling story about an adventurous and complicated woman living in a lush new land facing slave revolts, hurricanes, a cholera epidemic, a caste system, and the impact of the U.S. Civil War on that island colony. Esmeralda Santiago is a writer and a filmmaker, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And congratulations on your new sprawling novel.
Thank you very much. Really happy to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you here as well. And I'm wondering what the germ was that got this novel started.
The novel begins with my curiosity about the history of Puerto Rico. I was taken from the island when I was 13 years old, when my mother decided to move to New York. And so I stopped learning about the history in the schools I was in the United States. And the older I became, the more curious I was about Puerto Rico, about the history of my parents' history also. And I began to read as much as I could. This has been going on for a couple of decades, just trying to educate myself about my background and my ancestors.
And I'm assuming your ancestors or some of your ancestors came from Spain?
Some of them on my mother's side, definitely. And then on my father's side, definitely some from Africa. So I had the whole spectrum.
And Anna, how would you describe her?
I would describe her as a visionary, a passionate woman, somebody who's very focused, somebody who's very ambitious, and someone who has decided that, unusual for that woman, that she would just get convention and society upside down, that she was going to do what she wanted to do regardless.
And were there conquistadoras?
I imagine that there were. I did not find any journals or diaries or any accounts that were specific to any women at that time. But I did find many documents where, you know, an owner was a female. Many of them were widows of hacendados who then they then had to manage them. But I pretty much had to invent her.
Conquistadors, though, as you write in this book, many were impoverished. Many were actually the illegitimate children of wealthy, connected families.
Yes. The conquistadores were a whole group of them that were, of course, soldiers who had no more wars to fight. And then there were the young men who the only option they had was to go to sea. Right. And so many of them, we have these, you know, we imagine Ponce de León and we imagine Cortés and Hernando Pizarro, but those guys were actually illegitimate sons of important men. Huh. So they had no fortune, and so this was their only way for them to get one.
And she reads these journals and diaries. Did you read a lot of journals and diaries of these conquistadors?
Yes, I did. And they were really hard to read because it's this ancient Spanish that I had to read and really try to figure it out and then translate it into my current modern Spanish. And then, of course, I write in English. So it felt for me like it was a constant process of translation.
Anna is, and she's a fascinating character. She's a complicated character. She's not beautiful. I mean, she's not ugly or anything like that. And I was wondering if that was a conscious choice on your part.
It was very conscious. I read a lot of novels. I read a lot of 19th century novels. And I just, it's just annoying to me that all heroines are pretty or beautiful or, you know, just so fetching. And so I wanted to find a woman who was not, you know, deformed or ugly in some way, but who was not in any, no great beauty, but yet had an attraction that men were attracted to her. And so that they were attracted to her intelligence and her ability to get things done, which is, I think, to me, much more important.
She has, I shall say, an unusual marriage. Can you yes. Marry her to a twin?
Yes. Ramon and Inocente are identical twins who share everything. And she marries Ramon. And before she even realizes it, they are sharing her.
Right.
And so this is one of the things that begins to kind of change this romantic notions that she brought to Puerto Rico about what it would be like, what the island would be holding for her. And at the beginning, when she learns this, she has to make some adjustments in her own relationships and how she thinks about her marriage and what she plans to do about it.
And just to complicate it, she also has a friend, Elena, who mm-hmm. she had met in a convent school. And they love each other. Yes. They've had a physical, sounds like a sexual relationship right. with each other.
Yes, well, you know, they fall in love with each other, and they were young girls, and they loved one another not only physically, but they're emotionally, intellectually matched, and for me, it was this idea that you don't know who you're going to fall in love with, and so she falls in love with her, and Elena falls in love with her, and they try to figure out a way to be together, which complicates the situation.
Indeed, and we don't want to give too much away here. Was that fun though to explore this? You know, I would say unusual relationship between these four people. Really.
Yes, it was really hard for me because, of course, you know, I haven't experienced everything I write about. And so a lot of it was asking some of my friends and a lot of reading and then just imagining what it might be like. And one of the things that's sort of funny for people who know me is my husband is an identical twin as well.
Oh, is that right?
But you have to say, no, the twins in my book have nothing to do with the twins I know.
Are you sure about that?
Oh, I'm sure.
Funny how the unconscious works, though,
yes,
don't you think?
I know it is. Well, I'm fascinated. You know, my writing is about identity. And, of course, if you're writing about identity, you have to look into twinships and multiple births because it brings up a lot of issues and questions and concerns. And this was one of them for me.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And I'd love to have you read a section from the book. And this is where Anna and her husband arrive in Puerto Rico. And they are going there to run a sugar plantation. And again, Esmeralda Santiago is our guest, and her new novel is called Conquistadora.
Farther in, the trail widened, but brambles and vines choked the vegetation along both sides. Anna had read that Puerto Rico didn't have the large four-legged predators one would expect in a jungle. But that was hard to believe, given the thick forest and the rustling, screeching, grunting sounds that came from it. When they made a turn, a bright green parrot, the undersides of its wings a startling turquoise, flew across the path, shrieking wildly, spooking the horses and causing the hounds to bark angrily. Farther along, Anna saw a huge snake coiled on a hummock of red dirt, its diamond-shaped head draped daintily over its body. They rode single file through portions of the trail, Ramon and Inocente managing to keep Anna between them. The dog stayed on either side of Severo's horse, their eyes scanning the vegetation, barking at unseen threats. Every once in a while, one of them started into the bush, but a whistle from Severo brought him back, as docile, Anna thought, as Jesus's pugs. Pepe and the two slaves, Alejo and Curro, brought up the rear. Pepe rode a mule, but the men carrying the valises and parcels walked on bare feet over the pebbly, uneven terrain. Within a few minutes of entering the forest, the three were far behind. Pepe urged Alejo and Curro to walk faster, his voice growing fainter, until eventually it was swallowed into the rustling of leaves and the screech of parrots. One minute they were in the forest, and the next they emerged into an open valley in many shades of green, from pale, almost yellow, to olive. Grayish lavender tassels rippled over some fields. "That's the guajana," Severo said, "the cane flower that indicates when the stalks are ready for harvest." In the far distance, soft-edged mountains stretched west to east. What land wasn't under cultivation was forested. Scattered over the valley, smokestacks pointed to the sky from the surrounding green.
And that's a beautiful reading, a beautiful, lush description of Puerto Rico.
Well, you know, I grew up in the country of Puerto Rico, and much of the descriptions are memory from having grown up there until I was 13, and of course, my constant return.
And these mountains and the greenery, the thick forest that's still there?
There's still a lot of it. It's every time I go, there's less of it. But definitely you can still get into the country and go into the mountains, and it's absolutely just beautiful.
Now, this is the 19th century. Ana has come to Puerto Rico. It's a colony
of Spain.
And there is slavery, even though Spain had actually abolished slavery in the beginning of the 19th century.
They abolished slavery in Spain, but not in their colonies. And so the colonies actually, much of the South America revolutions, that's how they were able to abolish slavery, was whenever they, you know, with the civil wars and the wars against Spain. Puerto Rico has always been a prison camp as well as a military outpost. So it was very difficult for Puerto Ricans to rebel and to try and change things, because most of the people who were there were employed by the Spanish crown. They were soldiers, and many of them just stayed there.
And there were these slave codes that kept slaves slavery.
Yes, they did. They kept them in slavery because the laws were so strict. Things that you can't even imagine today. But things like, you know, a slave is not allowed to look at a white person in the eyes, or if a slave is walking on a path or a street or a road and a white person comes by, they have to cede the path for them, and you could be punished if you didn't do that, and things like that. But beyond that, the other way that they managed to keep the slaves from rebelling as much as they probably could have is that they kept them isolated into the haciendas, and they just didn't let them go out, and so it was very difficult for them.
There was in 1848 a proclamation against the African race. What did that say?
Yes, in 1848, the Bando contra Raza Negra, and that's what I was describing earlier, where they made it was the islands of Martinique and Guadeloupe were about to be abolishing slavery, and the slaves heard about it on those islands, and they actually went ahead and they began to rebel. Before the laws were abolished, they just wanted to happen immediately, and so the Puerto Rican governor at the time was really terrified that then this was going to happen in Puerto Rico, and they set up these laws that were just incredibly strict. Two men talking together would punish you just for talking to someone, because they thought if there's two people talking together, they were trying to run away, things like that. And that law was one of the most painful things for me to read about and then to write about, because I had not heard about this. Of course, they teach it in Puerto Rico, but I wasn't there. And so those kinds of things were so difficult for me to read and embarrassed. You know, it was shaming for me that this was part of our lives.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Our guest is Esmeralda Santiago, and she's written a number of books, including three memoirs. Her newest one is a novel, and it's called Conquistadora. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
Join fellow WHYY members in New Orleans for the Jazz Event, a Ken Burns American Journeys event by Talc. Spend 5 days and four nights exploring the birthplace of jazz with special tours and backstage events at Preservation Hall, the LSM Jazz Museum, Basin Street, and other legendary institutions, plus a performance by Ellis Marsalis and a chance to meet Ken Burns. Visit whyy.org/member experience or call 877-356-4547 for more.
She has been called the voice and the queen of clubland. She's ruled dance floors for the past three decades, redefined the image of the club singer, and even managed to change the rules in the music industry. A special performance and chat with R&B diva Martha Wash. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Esmeralda Santiago, and her new novel is called Conquistadora. It's the story of a restless young aristocratic Spanish woman who travels to Puerto Rico looking for a better life, set in the 19th century. And she comes and with her husband, and they own a sugar plantation in Puerto Rico. How common was that at this time, that there were so many sugar plantations?
There were many, many of them. Most of them were very small, under 75 acres, some of them just about 10 or 15. It really depended on the area. The island was still developing, and the sugar industry was just beginning to really boom. But there were many, all around the littoral, actually.
And these were worked on by slaves.
All of them. All of them were worked by slaves. And it was at that time it was believed that they were much better at working because they came from Africa and it's hot. And there was all these ridiculous reasons for doing it. But in Puerto Rico, it was law that there would be no more than 12% of the population would be Africans. However, the slave owners were very smart about smuggling in a larger number of Africans, and because they didn't want to pay the taxes on them. So to report that they had them meant that they had to pay taxes on them.
In that reading, we meet Severo, yes. And he's the manager, essentially the manager of, yes, of this sugar plantation.
Severo is a young man who comes also from Puerto Rico, from a different part of Spain. He's from the northern part of Madrid. And he comes, again, just looking for his riches, you know, and imagining that he would become a wealthy caballero. And these people all come together in various ways, to all of them with a vision.
Yeah. And he has no hesitation beating slaves, punishing slaves for various infractions.
Not at all. That he thinks of that as his job. The law says that he can do this. And for him, it's about, you know, I have permission to do this, and I will do whatever it takes to do what I need to do.
And Anna allows him to do it. I mean, she doesn't do it herself, but she gets him. I mean, it's his job, and
right,
she doesn't wash her hands of it.
Yeah.
But she doesn't participate, but she also doesn't want to know about it.
Right. The way she excuses herself is, he is in charge of the labor force, and I'm not going to be involved with that because, you know, one person has to be in charge of that. And so she kind of just looks in the other direction.
Was it tempting to want to make her, you know, be a abolitionist or somebody like that to try to stop slavery? Because she's not.
Yes. Oh, I was so tempted to do so many things that these characters just really challenged me, because the more I wrote about them, the more their own personalities emerge from the, both from the research and just they themselves. But it was really hard for me. And in fact, I had many more pages than you will read in this book about these kinds of issues and characters who were much more involved with that. But it's a real, you know, the other part of it is, for me, at a certain point, I just had to say, well, you know, I can't look at it from the 21st century perspective. I have to really stay with who they are. And that kind of kept me there.
And I've heard other novelists say the same thing, which is that you create a character and then this character takes on a life of their own. But it's so interesting that you have a character who's doing things to which you object.
Yes, it was really hard.
Maybe mad at her.
I just wanted to shake her sometimes. And sometimes I would be so upset with them, you know, because they did things that just go counter to every other fiber of my being. But, you know, but as a writer, you really have to be responsible to your characters and to what they're telling you. And it sounds almost like, you know, you're schizophrenic or something like that. There's something wrong with you that you're imagining these people, that they're like real people, but they are, as you're, when you're in this process.
As you said, you wrote this book in part to figure out where you came from or some, did your family come from? I mean, did this help explain your family to some degree?
It helped me to understand the history in which during the time when they lived. I haven't yet, and I probably would have been a lot easier for me to just go to one of the websites that you can look for your ancestry, but right. I didn't do that. Although one of my readers did that and found my father's great-grandfather, who actually came to Puerto Rico the same year that Anna did, and he was an African. And she found that long after I had finished writing this book. And it was very, very interesting that, you know, how did that place, that age, that year come into my mind? Well, maybe it just goes down the DNA, you know.
And I guess for a lot of people in Puerto Rico, there's African ancestry and Spanish ancestry.
And European. In 1815, Spain invited any white person in Europe to come to Puerto Rico, and they would give them land. And as long as they came with money and they committed to being for 5 years, you can come from any part of Europe or any part of their empire. And so we had people from France, from Italy, Germans, a lot of Dutch, a lot of Irish. And so there's just a real mixture from all over that part of the world.
I don't want to give too much away, but I'll give a little bit away. Anna becomes a widow. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to see that she hooked up with Severo, her manager. And there's it's just a page, but it's just a wonderful scene of, frankly, of them making love.
Yes. Well, you know, I've been writing memoirs for about 15 years, and they're about my life and my adolescence and my childhood. I hadn't had a chance to explore sexuality very closely. So I was so excited to be able to explore the various ways that men and women and women and women and men and men can get together.
Well, in fact, she says, or you write, that he made love like a woman.
Yes, because she had the experience with the twins, who were, their attitude was, you know, this is my wife, so I have to be respectful. And, you know, the kinds of things that I would really like to do, I will do with prostitutes, but I'm going to be respectful of my wife. And so she realizes that, whoa, there's a whole other universe out here. When Severo makes love to her in the way that a man who loves a woman does.
And that's Esmeralda Santiago, our guest today on Radio Time. She is a writer. She has written several memoirs. She has a new novel called Conquistadora, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Is it interesting, challenging to write a novel that is set in a certain time and place, because you also write about this cholera epidemic, which truly did happen.
Yes.
And just ravaged so much of this island.
Yes. All the historical events are actually things that happened in Puerto Rico in the years that I say, like, you know, the hurricanes, the cholera, the Bando Negro, all that. And then the governors are all real, and Betances was a real person. And it was really important to me to keep the history as accurate as I possibly could, because it was important to me that it be accurate. But I have to say about the cholera that was so interesting is that I kept finding little snippets about, there was just one sentence, there was a cholera epidemic in 1855, and then nothing more. And so I had to find out about it, and over the course of several years, really discovering how devastating it was. But it wasn't in the history books the way that I feel it ought to be, especially given the fact that 75% of the people who died were slaves and free blacks. I thought, wow, you know, that's not the kind of thing we want to forget.
We talked about some of the slave codes. There were also slave revolts.
There were several slave revolts, but again, because Puerto Rico, there were so many soldiers all the time, all over the island, it was really difficult. If they ran out to sea, they would be captured by pirates who they just went around the islands specifically to find people who were running away and then bringing them back or selling in other places. And then when they go into the island, it is this very small island. It's only 100 miles by 35 miles. So there's really not too many places they could run to. And it was impossible for them to put together a rebellion because they were isolated.
You also write about the impact of the U.S. Civil War, the American Civil War on Puerto Rico. And that's true?
Yes, it was true. And it was very interesting to me because not only for Puerto Ricans, but people who know a little bit about Puerto Rico, you know, we kind of think that the history of Puerto Rico begins with the invasion of the U.S. Navy in 1898. But there were a lot of Americans in the mid-19th century because they were there to trade. And there's one character here called Mr. Worthy, Vincent Worthy, who I called Vicente, or he called himself Vicente. And there were people who already understood that there was a potential connection between the United States and Puerto Rico, even at that early stage. And with the Civil War, of course, the sugar industry in the United States was devastated. And so both Cuba and Puerto Rico were benefited from that because they had the sugar and they could ship it.
And did you travel? I know you have family in Puerto Rico. You grew up there in part. But did you travel? You go to Spain, go to Puerto Rico, go to other places to do your research?
Oh, yes. It was fun to be in Sevilla.
Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with Sevilla.
And I did go to Sevilla, and I went to the archives there. And, I grew up in Puerto Rico, so I'm there frequently. And I happened to have had the opportunity to go to Cuba with a group of writers and had an opportunity to visit haciendas that were still operating and just see some historical haciendas that are being maintained as museums. So I really had an opportunity to actually touch some of the objects, which was very exciting for me.
And when were you in Cuba, and how did you get there, and who were the writers?
In Cuba, this was part of I was one of the jury of the Casa Las Americas prize for books written by Spanish authors all over all over Latin America. Actually, right. If you're writing in Spanish, you could have been in the United States as well. But my particular group of writers was reading things in English because there were some, of course, in the Caribbean, there's some schools and writers. And so I was reading those, and I had, I think, about 15 or 12 of them that I had to read in the space of 10 days because they don't give it to you ahead of time. So I read a lot.
Do you write in Spanish?
I write in both languages, but my literary language is English. And so this book was written in English. It's also then it's translated into Spanish. And right now it's available in both languages simultaneously.
Now, do you do this the translation of your own
I didn't
English?
Do it because it had to be done very quickly. And because I have learned that there's some really wonderful, wonderful translators. And, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I have a lot of books I want to write. And so I'd really rather to focus on continuing to write new material.
So do you think in Spanish or is that just...
It's simultaneous. Yeah. It's very strange. In fact, sometimes when I'm speaking and I stop, it's because I have to translate because I'm speaking in both languages at the same time.
Are you really? Even as we speak?
Oh, even as you and I are speaking, you know, I jump into Spanish because I can't think of it in English and then I have to go through my...
We need subtitles
internal,
here, right?
Yeah, my internal dictionary and thesaurus, you know, trying to find the proper language. It's really funny.
Must have a very active brain working.
Sí, claro, sí. Yo puedo hablar ambos idiomas a la misma vez. It happens all the time.
Oh, interesting. But so you're used to it by now.
Yes, I'm used to it. And when I'm with somebody who's bilingual, then I can do that. I can speak in both languages simultaneously or consecutively, whatever. So it's a lot faster for me.
You were telling me before we began our interview that this book took about 10 years.
The research was so it was so hard and it took so long. And yes, it's been over 10 years for the research. The actual writing of it, I would say, was about 3 to 4 years of solid work. Yeah.
And I also heard that this is perhaps the first of a trilogy.
I hope so.
That's the plan. Anyway,
the plan is if this book sells well, hopefully Knopf will say yes to the next one.
And we'll find out more about Anna and her family.
Anna, we're going to continue. A lot of these characters will continue, definitely. I've already begun the second the second book, and I'm into about chapter 3 or 4. And, Anna, you know, Anna and Severo are, they continue to talk. And my big challenge, actually, for the next book is that they don't hijack the next book as well.
Shame on them, right? How dare them do that to the writer. I also read that you had a stroke while working on this book. Is that true?
Yes, I did. And this is another reason why it took so long, is that I was about 3/4 of the way of my first draft. It was about to deliver very soon. And I had a stroke that made it impossible for me to read or write for about a year and a half.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that was challenging. But, I got over it and was able to, when this book arrived in my house, at my door, and it was done and it was published, that's when I felt like, okay, I've recovered. Because for the whole time, it was really scary.
Did you know you were having a stroke?
I did, but I didn't believe it. And it's just, you know,
symptoms, right?
Yes. Well, the symptoms were odd. And so I just thought I was tired and, you know, I'd been working really hard and those kinds of things. So I didn't really, and I said, am I having a stroke? One of those, you know, am I ridiculous kind of thing? But when the symptoms became worse and I went to my doctor, it was confirmed. And, I couldn't read. It was gibberish.
You look at the words. I mean, there was just
not understand it. I knew that whatever was on the page was something comprehensible to somebody else, but not to me. I could read the paper. I'd pick up a newspaper, and I just knew that this had been very carefully edited. It wasn't gibberish, and it took a long, long time to make that connection between what I saw and read and what I could understand. I didn't lose the ability to understand if I heard things. So if you and I talked, I listened to a lot of audiobooks just to help myself feel like a reader.
But did you have to teach yourself to read again?
Yes, I had to. I had to start all over again.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
With The Cat in the Hat?
Just like, you know, just like a child.
And how about writing? Was that also?
That was also challenging. And I could write. It was just so weird. I could write and I knew what I was writing, but I couldn't read it. So I had to trust that whatever my hand was saying was what I meant to say, because then I couldn't read it back to myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was bizarre.
I bet. Yeah. And was it sort of the slow returning then of these skills?
It was a slow process. And I remember that I knew that I was able to create new material, because as I was coming back, I was able to then read other things that had been written or my own work being able to. Mm-hmm. But when I was able to create a new scene and understand it, then I knew that those connections were beginning to build up and that I was able to finish the book, which was my big, big goal.
And then we're almost right. So that the words on the page then look like words, not just that you'd written, but that these were real words that had real meaning made sense together.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. It was hard.
I bet. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And Esmeralda Santiago is our guest today on Radio Time. She is a writer. She's a filmmaker, grew up in Puerto Rico, moved with her family to Brooklyn when she was just 13 years old. We'll be talking more about her life after we take this very short break. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Abington Friends School, a Quaker college preparatory school for students in preschool through grade 12. At Abington Friends, they know their students well. For all 4 years of upper school, students stay with the same faculty advisor, forming close relationships that often develop into lifelong friendships. Fully supported and valued for who they are and who they can be, Abington Friends helps students become more skillful at connecting, collaborating, and developing their abilities. More at abingtonfriends.net. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is a group that brings together state legislators and representatives of large corporations to draft model bills. An archive of ALEC documents was recently leaked to the Center for Media and Democracy. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with journalist John Nichols of The Nation about what these documents reveal. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Monica Brady Meyerhoff. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What the debt ceiling deal could mean for Social Security, Medicare, mortgage interest deductions, and more. Also, as the U.S. shuttle program ends, we'll look at China's ambitious space program. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Esmeralda Santiago. She is a writer. She's a filmmaker. Grew up, as I said, in Puerto Rico. She has written three memoirs, including When I Was Puerto Rican. And she has a new novel. It's a sprawling historical novel called Conquistadora. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk a little bit about your life, but let me get Henry from Bucks County to join us. And Henry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there. Hello? Go ahead. Yes, go ahead, Henry.
Hi. Okay. I was born in Puerto Rico back in 1940s, and I had a question regarding what my father told me about the conquistadors versus the way in which the novel was based. And the conquistadors, after they conquered the Boricua Indians, that they built the El Moro Castle and all the military placements to protect against pirates, like English pirates and others. Is that what you found out also?
Yes, yes. Thanks, that's Henry. Correct. Thank you, Henry. Yes, the El Moro was a way to protect the island, of course, and also to provide a place where soldiers could live, because then they would come there, and then from there they would go to other parts of the Spanish Empire.
Henry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me just talk a little bit about your life. You grew up, as you said, in Puerto Rico. You were the oldest of
11 children.
11 children.
Yes.
And you grew up in a rural part of Puerto Rico.
Yes. My family, on both sides, my mother and father, are landless peasants. And they were campesinos. And in the 30s, my dad is about 10 years older than my mom, and they just had to leave the land because the land was taken over by people who had more money, basically. Mm-hmm. They were agregados. Agregados meant that you could stay in the land so long as you gave some of the produce that you grew in the land, and that was them. And so their family went to different cities of Puerto Rico, and so my mom grew up in Mayagüez, which is on the western side of the island, and my father in the San Juan metropolitan area. But reading about that time and listening to my parents, it was so illuminating for me, because, you know, we rarely spend a lot of time asking our parents about their lives before they met us. And the more I listened to them, the more I learned. And they were very inspiring in the process of writing this book, because it made me want to bring attention to these kinds of people, not the people who could write, who had the journals, who wrote poetry, very romantic poetry, but the people who just lived and worked and loved and made it possible for the island to continue developing.
Was your family poor?
Yes, very, very poor. I grew up, it's hard for me to say it today, we're in this land of technology, but we had no running water, we had no electricity. I did not see television until I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. It existed, we just didn't have it where we lived. And it was a whole other, we really did live a 19th century life when I began to write this book, I realized, oh, well, I remember a lot. It's 200 years later, we're still doing the same thing.
You came, I guess, with your mother and yes. and some of your siblings, too.
Yes, there were seven when we first came. And then right. my mother married here, and then she had another four children.
Right. So, and came to Brooklyn, right?
We went to Brooklyn, and very challenging neighborhoods, and very scary for me coming from... you know, a rural community where everybody knows one another. It was very, you know, really helped one another. I remember the one thing that was most terrifying to me was that we lived in these apartments, and you go in there and you had like three or four locks. I just couldn't understand that. I'd be like, why do we? Who? You mean our neighbors can't just barge in to borrow sugar or something? That kind of thing was. Mm-hmm. was terrifying, and it made it kind of, you know, really turned my whole idea of what people are upside down if we can't if we have to live behind locked doors all the time.
Did you speak English when your family?
No.
Did anybody in the family speak English?
Nobody did, and there was no bilingual education at the time. So basically what they used to do then is as they tried to do with me as I came in, I had just finished seventh grade, and so what they would do is send you one grade back with the aid. I don't know who came up with that idea, but they said, well, if you repeat seventh grade, you're going to learn English faster. I'm like, no, that's ridiculous. I had really good grades in seventh grade. I was very proud about that. And I said, I'll just go into eighth and I'll do, you know, I'll just really struggle. And I did. I would go to the library and get children's illustrated books with the objects so that I could learn the English
words.
The cat
and the hat,
exactly,
right.
Exactly. And then, you know, just going from the illustrated books to the one with whole sentences, and then I have adverbs, you know. It was very, very, it was an exciting process, I must admit. But within about a year and a half, I was very fluent.
Did you also watch TV? This thing, did that help your English as well?
We finally did get TV, but my mother and my grandmother, who lived with us, insisted that we watch the television, the Spanish station. But we did get the $1 million movie every Saturday afternoon, and then during the week she wouldn't allow us to watch TV, so that we would, you know, do our work and do our homework.
Well, you managed to get into it's often described with the adjective prestigious performing arts high school.
Performing arts high school. And that was one of these things where I've been very, very fortunate that there have been teachers in my life who have recognized something in me that I haven't yet discovered about myself, but they did. And so one of the teachers really felt that a place like performing arts would be helpful to me, that I would learn English quickly, that I was really, really shy at the time. I mean, I think mostly not so much shy, but terrified all the time. And so he felt that it would help me. And so I was able to get through the audition and go there for 3 years and came out speaking English.
With the idea of maybe I'll be an actress?
Well, I did get right out of high school a small part in Up the Down Staircase, which
you get
still,
out that dome yes, video, right?
You can still see it, and I look very, very young. But being in that movie taught me that it was not for me. I didn't like all the fuss they make of actors and a lot of waiting around, and then the whole audition process was something that I didn't I didn't understand it and I didn't like it, and also I just didn't, you know, because of the way I looked very, very ethnic, and I wasn't getting any jobs, and I said, you know, I have to pay the rent, I'm just not going to work in this. And I was much more interested in the back, the behind the scenes kind of thing, and started studying filmmaking. That's what I've been doing.
But I'm sure it's true for any child that comes to this country from another country. Obviously, parents coming, in this case, your mother coming, wanting probably a better life for her children, for her daughter. And yet there are these ties to the old country, or in this case, to Puerto Rico. And, you know, are you an American? Are you Puerto Rican?
Well, we are born American in Puerto Rico. So we're Puerto Rican. We don't have to be Puerto Rican American. Mm-hmm. We're just strictly a Puerto Ricans. And so you can't lose that. I mean, that's who you are. Now that I live here, I'm a real hybrid. Mm-hmm. I'm both things. You know, I'm Puerto Rican and and American, just the way I was born. I speak both languages. Doesn't mean that I'm less Puerto Rican because I'm bilingual. It just means I'm a different kind of Puerto Rican from the one who doesn't. And I try to, especially with young people, because there's a lot of there are a lot of challenges around that. You know, you go back to your country, not just Puerto Rico, but wherever you're from, and if you've lived in another place, you go back home, and the people there feel like you're contaminated or, you know, in some way you're no longer who you were. And it's a big challenge to remind them, you know, I'm the same person. Mm. I'm just different now because that experience is different.
And some of those things must be so subtle because it's body language.
Yes.
I mean, it's the subtle things that you can absorb living in another culture.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, I remember when I returned to Puerto Rico after not living there for, you know, 8 or 9 years, the big challenges were that I was very direct. I looked people in the eye, and I was kind of a pushy woman especially for the men in the culture. It was hard for them. You know, they didn't even want to date me. Forget about wanting to employ me or anything like that, because I was a little bit too much for them. I was too intense. I kept hearing all the time I was too intense, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, you're just gonna have to deal with it.
Well, I noticed one of your memoirs is titled "When I Was Puerto Rican," and of course I'm emphasizing the word "was."
Right, and it was really I was very deliberate for me in that title was to try and get people to think about that. What does that mean? What does it mean to be Puerto Rican? And is it possible? No, to not be who you are. But I think people who read the book at the beginning, they might be, and many readers have told me this, they picked up the book really angry with that title, and then they realize by the end, oh, I really understand what it means. Mm-hmm. It's a question. It's a way for us to talk about identity.
But did your mother have a different vision for you than you might have had for yourself in this country?
I think she had a vision for her children, and she was very strict about it. And because I was the eldest, you know, the eldest is always the one to be pushed and to be the rebel and all those things. I got it very early that I have to learn English. I have to learn some kind of a profession or a career, un oficio, we would say in Spanish, so that I could get, I would be financially independent. Mm-hmm. Because she was very embarrassed that sometimes she had to go to welfare when she would be laid off. She was a factory worker, and so sometimes they would just, you know, just close the place down really literally overnight. And so she had to go to the welfare because she had to take care of her children, and it was always a humiliating experience. And she said, I want you all to be educated so that you can have good jobs, so that you don't have to do this, because it was horrible for her. And she's a very proud woman. So I really learned those lessons very, very, very strictly and have kept to it.
But it's interesting, you've written three memoirs.
Yes.
I mean, is that in part your, I mean, obviously it's part your exploration of yourself.
Yes.
And who you are.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. And also this, you know, like I said earlier, I just can't believe that my early age, you know, my first years were the way they were. Because right now, I take it so much for granted right now in my life, but I remember just how different that life was, and so writing the books really helped me to explore that. Mm-hmm. and to explore myself, to explore my family, and those of the people that I love, because they were in there with me.
And is Anna, and I know that there's memoir and there's fiction, but do you identify with some parts of Anna? Because she also, she goes from Spain to Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And you went from Puerto Rico to the United
States.
I
know. And this is really, it was really funny. She goes from Spain to Puerto Rico to become Puerto Rican.
That's
and
right.
She does. You know? But I think I'm just so fascinated by that whole idea of moving from one culture, one place to another. And everything that entails, all the adventure, all the drama, all the struggle, all the joys and all the beauty. And so that's what my work is about. Yeah. Is really that transition is really important to me.
It's interesting, though, you didn't become an actress. You did become a filmmaker, but you also became a writer. Did writing then come after filmmaking?
It came consecutively. I've always, since I was very little, I was a big reader. My family didn't have books, but my dad would bring the newspapers every single day from whatever job he had. And so he made it, he just left it around. And so I learned to read very, very early and always would just devour anything within sight that I could read, I would read. And so many, many years I just read constantly. I began to write when my first child was born. And I was living in a small town, southeast Massachusetts, and I realized I'm the only Puerto Rican here. and now that my child is going to get to know his mother, he needs mm-hmm. to know about this history. You know, who is this lady? You know, and why does she look so different? So it began with that question, you know, how to bring my story to him so that he would know who his mother was.
And do you write, when you write, is it a struggle for you? I mean, for some writers, it can be a struggle. For others, it's not. How about for you?
For me, I make appointments with myself to write. I don't really have time to write every single day like Stephen King, who has a very strict schedule. I write January and February and June, July, August, and part of September. And the rest of the time, I'm working with my husband with his film company, and I travel a lot doing lectures and traveling, talking about literature wherever anyone asks me.
So why those months? So January, February?
Well, January and February because we live in upstate New York, and
it's
I
cold.
I don't want to go anywhere, so I pretty much just stay in the house. and the other months I go to Maine, where I have a little cottage where I just can disappear for the summer and just be, you know, with no distractions.
And are you happy when you write?
I love it. I wish I could do it 12 months of the year. I would really, this is my dream, is to just be able to do that all the time and just continue to create new things. And then there's so many characters that I want to explore, and so many themes and issues and questions that I have. That's what I'd like to do with the rest of my life.
And is it sad when a book is over?
No. I've heard that from writers who say, oh, I guess it's like, no, I'm excited. I think it's great. It's like having a child. It's like all of a sudden they're out there in their own universe. You can't control what happens out there. All you can do is observe it. And so I'm having such a blast with this book tour. Philadelphia is my third stop. I've had two amazing readings, and I'm enjoying every aspect of it.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Esmeralda Santiago, our guest, and she has written several books, including a new novel, and it's called Conquistadora. John Knapp, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.